everybody. I'm just going to quickly introduce Rabbi Forth. He needs no introduction. This is his second time joining us in Yeshiva to pleasure us with a shiur, and we're very thankful to have him join us and to have the opportunity to hear his words of Torah and hear his expertise and speak about Nyan Adiyom a very interesting time. So everybody just enjoy and enjoy the shiur.
Okay, can you guys see that? Is that too small?
Can you make it bigger?
Let's see if we get
Okay, that's good, a lot better.
Out of the way here. Okay, hi everybody, nice to see you. My name is David Forman, and it's nice to see you all. We'll do this kind of interactive style, so feel free to introduce yourself if you make a comment, so I know who you are. My general rule is I'm allowed to forget your name five times before you get insulted. That's how we kind of work it. Good time to turn off your cell phones. I'm going to do that myself. Okay. All right, just so I get a sense of what to do here and what not to do here, I just don't want to repeat stuff that people have heard. I wrote a book on the Megillah. If you happen to have read it, raise your hand. Okay? All right, so we've got some people who've read that. Okay, great. So I'm going to do kind of a little bit of an epilogue to that book. It'll touch on some of the themes in the book, but it's not really going to repeat it exactly. Okay. Let me begin with... let me also say, by the way, if you aren't into reading, but you like videos, I run a video production place called Aleph Beta. We put out a series on Purim this year, which is actually from the book, from the second part of the book. Anybody happen to see it? Raise your hand if you saw it. Somebody? Nobody? Okay. So it's a lot of fun. They have smart boards here, or sound? They don't really have sound. They have sound here? Yeah, so maybe I'll show, I can show you what it looks like. You can go to it later. But it's actually a lot of fun. Our animators have gotten really good with this stuff. Looks like this. So you want to be able to see it here. But if it weren't for that, you could see it here. So it's olivebeta.org. Here you go. But you don't have any sound.
Yeah, the sound's on the right.
The sound
unmythical.
Is on the right. Oh, here we go.
Okay, we can pass.
All right, guys, anyway, this isn't going to work here, but that's fine. You can watch here at dollarfeta.org. So let's turn that off right here.
Okay, so I want to share with you some issues which have kind of bothered me over the years. I don't know if they bothered you, but I'll kind of start in with them. One of the things that's always puzzled me, and hopefully we'll have a chance to get to it tonight, is, you know, we all know that the Megillah is another iteration of the war against Amalek. That's how we see it. The command to wipe out Amalek, Parsha Zachar, how is it that we, as ethical people, relate to that command? Right? That's a tough one. This notion that we're supposed to utterly wipe out man, woman, and child, another entire nation. You know, we're familiar with genocide. It hasn't been that many years since we've been the victim of something like that. How is it that we relate to a command to wipe out Amalek? Why do we hate them so much? Why do they hate us so much? How is it that we understand that? As a kid, growing up in yeshiva, a lot of the explanations which I would get is somewhere along the line, sort of metaphysical explanations. Amalek represents pure evil in one way, shape, or form. However you define pure evil, Amalek represents it. And getting rid of Amalek is getting rid of pure evil. My problem with that is the question is, do we believe that that's really true? Do we really think that there is something right here on earth which is sort of, by definition, pure, irredeemable evil? How do we relate to that? If I'm a Christian, right, I believe in something like that. We call it the devil, right? The devil is pure, irredeemable evil. And there's this war between the forces of the devil and the forces of God. And the forces of the devil is one source of power, and that's pure evil. And the forces of God is another source of power. And our job is to side with the forces of God. The problem is that if we conceptualize Amalek as a sort of metaphysical repository of evil, then what's the difference between that and the Christian devil? Right? So the Christian devil is supernatural, and Amalek isn't supernatural. Although maybe they are because they keep on popping up. You can't really get rid of them. So is it just sort of our version of the Christian devil? But I thought we don't really believe in the devil. So how is it that we relate to the command to get rid of Amalek? Why do they hate us? How is it that we understand that? Do Chazal have a perspective on why Amalek hates us? Do Chazal help us in understanding this question? This isn't the main thing I want to discuss with you tonight, but hopefully it's something that will emerge from what it is that we're kind of talking about. Okay, I'm going to try to talk kind of quickly and pack in a lot of things here, maybe more than I probably should pack in one session, but I'll give it a whirl anyway. Okay. Do you remember that part of the Megillah where Haman comes in the middle of the night to ask Ahasuerus permission to kill Mordechai? And the king comes and says, before you tell me anything, I have a question for you. What should we do with the man the king wants to honor? Right? So Haman says, can't believe it's anybody but him, and says, the man that the king wants to honor, Ish Asher HaMelech HaFetz Bikaro, right? So you just dress him up in all the fancy stuff of the king's clothes, and you should just parade him through the streets. And what should you say? Right? What should you say? Remember the language? Come on, guys, what should you say? By the way, when I ask you a question, the rule is you're actually supposed to respond. It's not a rhetorical question. I'm actually asking you, so you're supposed to respond. So one more time. What is it that Haman says? As he's been led through the streets, Haman says, you should call before the man, the Yikarei Lefanav. That's a very good. See, you guys are quick learners. Okay. Kacha Yaseh Le'ish, Asher HaMelech HaFetz Bikaro. That's what you should say. Yikarei Lefanav, right? Hamela Isha Shira Mela Chafetz Bikaro, the man that the king wants to honor. Yikare Lefanav Kacha Yasel Ish.
So it turns out that that wasn't the first time that that language is used. That language comes from somewhere. The Bala Megillah, the author of the Megillah, is actually imputing to Haman words that appear somewhere in Chumash. There's one place, one other place in Tanakh that you have the language Kacha Yasel Ish Asher, and only other one other place in all of Tanakh that you have that language. What's the only other Kacha Yasel Ish Asher that we ever have? That's it. It's Chalitza. Okay? The halacha of Chalitza in Dvarim, Chafei, has exactly the same language. It's the only other Kacha Yasel Ish in Tanakh. Kacha Yasel Ish Asher lo yivne es beis achiv. The choletz, right? This is what the woman says to the choletz as she spits in his face. Is there anything else? So you could say, well, maybe that's a coincidence. But is there anything else about chalitza that reminds you of what Haman is saying? Remember what Haman is saying? Haman is saying that ish asher amelach hafetz bikaro, the man that the king wants to honor, dress him up in these glorious clothes, the crown on his head, bikare lefanav. What?
Yeah.
The opposite. How's it the opposite?
That's honoring him, dressing him up. That the other one is degrading him for not lying with time. So.
Okay, good. Honoring him, dressing him up, it's actually opposites. Versus what is chalitza? Chalitza is degrading him by dressing him down. You're literally dressing him down. What are you doing? You're taking off what article of clothing? The shoe, right? The most degraded piece of clothing, as opposed to the crown, the top of the head, the most wonderful piece of clothing. Even the language of Yikare Lifanav, Kacha Yasel Ish, seems to be a play off of what phrase in Chalitza? What do you do? What's the pasuk right before Kacha Yasel Ish? Do you remember the words right before that? It's a play off of Yikare Lifanav. What does the woman do? The Yarkav Bifanav, right? And she says, Kacha Yasel Ish. So Yarkabafanav, right, becomes Vikarelafanav. She spits in his face, and that becomes Vikarelafanav. Even Isha Sharamela Chafetz Bikaro, what does Bikaro sound a lot like? Right, it's the same letters as Yarkabafanav, sort of rearranged. Even the word Chafetz, by the way, Isha Sharamela Chafetz Bikaro shows up in Chalitza where? Right? You guys learn Yavamas? So what happens? You have to learn Yavamas, you learn Devarim too. But. Right? But Isha Shara Melech Chafetz Bikaro, where do you have Chafetz, a man that wants? Lo Chafatzdi Lekachta, the Cholet says. I don't want to take her. So the question is, why is all the language of Haman's suggestion to the king, why does it come from Chalitza of all things? What a strange thing. Right? Why would the Bala Megillah do that? All right? So that's sort of question number two. Question number one, how do we understand it? Well, question number two, how is Chalitza connected to Haman? Question number three, in no particular order. Esther goes to the king the first time. The first time she goes to the king, she actually fails. She manages to kill Haman, but she doesn't actually succeed in getting the decree wiped out. She has to go to the king a second time for that. So her first attempt to go to the king is actually a failure, because if the Megillah ended right there, Haman would die, but the Jews would be killed anyway because the decree is on the books. When she goes to the king the first time, so she's very worried, she's about to point out Haman, she's at the feast. Imagine you had like a 2-minute counseling session with Esther the moment before she walked into that room with the king. All right, so you are the motivational speaker, you know, you've been called in, you're the consultant, $500 an hour. And you're there to just help her focus. What should she have in her head, right? What should she be thinking? What should she be channeling? As she's about to talk to the king, she's worried, right? How, whatever she says, she doesn't have a lot of time. She has 60 seconds with the king. What's her strategy? How should she want the king to view herself? In other words, what words should she be using? And how should she be trying to get the king to see himself? And how should she try to get the king to see herself? What would you say? Yes.
He should be seen as like the powerful in control, and she should be the damsel in distress.
Right, very good, right? Romance, right? That would be the way. So what is more romantic than the king loves her, right? And what does the king like? The king likes her, right? She's beautiful. He picked her out. So she's going to play the damsel in distress, right? And if she can make him seem like the knight in shining armor, so this is just going to be great. It's going to work out fine. As long as you can portray yourself as the damsel in distress and your people, and as long as you can portray the king as the potential man who can save you, everything should be fine. All right, keeping that in mind, let's grade Esther on her performance, okay? How well does Esther do at this, right? So let's see. Actually, this is not what we have up on the screen, so I'm going to rely on your memories instead, right? But we'll get back to this in a moment. Right, so if you have the McGill in front of you on your laptop, you can just listen to me or you can just go back to your memory. Here's what she says. All right, how would you grade her right now? If she stopped right now, how's she doing? Pretty good, right? That's an A. It's poetic. It's concise in four words. She has dramatically portrayed her plight. This is pretty good, right? A plus so far. Let's keep on going. Kinim karnu aniva amid, lashmid laharog ulaabed. Okay, how's she doing? Still pretty good, right? It's very dramatic. We're going to get killed. Now she's going to say something that seems, I believe, to make very little sense with the damsel in distress, knight in shining armor theory. She is now, if she stopped right here, if she ended her speech here, it would be a winner. But she doesn't. Instead, she digresses now. She digresses into a theoretical possibility, which is not even the case, which is besides the point, and what she says about it is very confusing, and really, you really have to hold cup. Remember, the king is at a wine feast, he's kind of a little bit drunk, and the argument she's going to make is very, very complex. It actually sounds less like a romantic argument and much more like an accountant at tax time with an Excel spreadsheet. This is basically what she says. She now goes and says, King, I need to discuss the following theoretical possibility, which is not actually the case. Ilu la'avadim v'lishvachos nimkarnu, had it not been the case that we were being sold to be killed, had we only been sold as slaves, hecharashti, I could have kept silent. I would have kept silent. Why? Ki ein hatsar shoveh menezek hamelech. Now, these words are hard to translate, but according to a lot of mafarshim, they mean something like the following. The benefit that accrues to us by being saved from merely being sold as slaves is not great enough to outweigh the damage to the king's treasury by the loss of the slave labor. So basically, she's making the following argument. She's saying, okay, let's set up a chart over here and take these two scenarios. Scenario number one, we're going to be killed. All right, on a scale from 0 to 10, 0 being not very bad at all, and 10 being the worst possible outcome, how bad is being killed?
10.
That's about a 10, right? About as bad as it gets. Okay. Now, that's for us, it's like a 10 if we're killed. Now, King, for you, how good is it for you if we're killed? How much benefit to the king's treasury do you get out of all of your loyal subjects dying?
Zero.
Okay? So it's a 0 for you, it's a 10 for us. Okay? Now let's take the other theoretical possibility. Let's imagine we were actually sold as slaves. Not going to be killed, we're only going to be sold as slaves. So on a scale from 0 to 10, with 0 being not so bad and 10 being really, really bad, how bad is it for everyone to be sold as slaves?
5, 4, 3, 9, 10.
Let's call it a 7, right? This is about a 7. All right, now, King, what do you get out of us being sold as slaves? We're going to be working for the king, right? So on a scale from 0 to 10, how much benefit is there, with 10 being all the economic problems of Persia are now gone, and 0 being no benefit at all?
Less than 7. 8.
It's not that good. We're not that good as slaves. It's a 3.5, right? You know, something. It's a 4. So basically what she's saying is all this. She is this. King, had it been the case that we were being sold as slaves, it's not really so bad for us. It's only a 7. It's not a 10. Plus, you get some benefit out of it. It's like a 3 or a 4 for your treasury. So then I would not have asked you to annul the decree just for that situation, except it's not the case. It's really bad for us because we're getting killed. Plus, it's no good for you because you're not even getting anything out of it. And that's why I am standing up and letting you know this king. However, I do need to mention that it's not the case that we're actually being sold as slaves. We're actually being sold as being killed. And that's why I'm speaking up. I wouldn't have spoken up the other way, king. Right? I mean, like, the king is lost. You know what I mean? He's totally lost. He hasn't been trained at the SISIM School of Business. He can't follow an Excel spreadsheet. He has no idea what's going on. And as a matter of fact, you see he completely loses the train of thought. He says, I guess Haman's a bad guy. Kills Haman. As for the decree, whatever. He just lost. And, in fact, the whole thing fails. Why did she say this? She was doing so well, and she just destroyed everything with this Ilulabadim Vishlof Hasbun Karnavat Harashti. Why is she saying this? You with me? All right, so that's question number three. By the way, can I ask somebody a favor? Do you think a bottle of water or a glass of water could be arranged? Do they have somebody? Yeah? Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Okay. Okay, while we're in Esther, just before we get to what's on the screen here for a moment, let's go back to one other, I think, crucial point in the Megillah. The moment when Mordechai makes his famous speech to Esther, that's probably the turning point in the Megillah. All right, so here's the situation. Mordechai finds out about Haman's genocidal decree. He sends word to Esther that this is the moment that she has to reveal herself to the king. She's the ace in the hole. Everything rides on her. She just has to go. Esther sends back word, I'd really love to help, but it's just the wrong time. Right? I haven't been called before the king for 30 days. Everybody knows if you're not called before the king for 30 days. Everyone knows if you invade the king's private chambers without an audit, without permission to have an audience, it's off with your head. And I really wish I could help. I just can't. Sorry. All right, you're Mordechai. You're going to send one last appeal back to her. Right? And you're thinking, what does she mean this isn't the right time? Doesn't she understand that we're all going to die? Right? What would you say to her? Forget what the Megillah says. What would you say to her? What would you say?
Everyone's going to be killed within
1 hour. Esther, this is no time to be thinking about your own life. What's the worst that will happen? They'll kill you? Sullivan High School's after you. You know what I mean? But this, you have to act. Your entire people, their existence depends upon you. We need you, Esther. Stand up and be a hero. Die if necessary, right, for the good of us all. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Oh, that's really great. Thanks. What does Mordechai actually say? He does not say this. He actually seems to say the opposite. Well, he says to her, "Zimacharesh tachrishi beit hazot." If you keep quiet right now, Esther, the one thing you need to know is we do not need you. We're totally fine without you. Totally fine. Don't think we need you in the slightest. We're totally good. As a matter of fact, Esther, do you know why you should act here? You should act because if you don't act, right, you're going to be the one going down in flames, not us. I mean, what kind of strange reverse psychology is this? Is he really so confident? He's so sure that everything is going to be fine? How does he know everything is going to be fine? Not only is everything going to be fine, but she's the one who's going to be in danger. We're going to be fine. You're going to be the one who's going to be in danger. Why? And it just seems strange. And I was like, let's take his logic to the nth degree for a moment. Let's say he really believes that everything's going to be fine without Esther. Right? It's really true that Reva Fatzala Yamad Laivim Mokam Lachar. For whatever reason, he knows it's true. The Jews are going to be saved one way for the other. Doesn't that give Esther exactly the opening she's looking for to bow out? Do you know what I mean? Like, if I'm Esther, you know what I say right now? Mordechai, I was really considering maybe sacrificing myself. But that moment when you said that we're totally going to be fine, one way or the other, you know, on second thought, I'm a little scared. I'm just going to bow out. Why don't you let somebody else, the Megillah can be named after somebody else, you let somebody else work this out. I think I'm going to sit out this one. If it were really, you know, if I could, you know, you let me know when it's really necessary for me to get involved, and then I'll get involved. Why can't she say that? It seems like the worst possible motivational speech that you could imagine. It just doesn't hold up. What really is his argument? Plus, if you listen carefully to his argument, it seems to be self-contradictory. Because what if I asked you this question? According to Mordechai, is Esther significant or insignificant?
Insignificant.
Significant or insignificant?
Insignificant.
All right, raise your hands if you think the answer to that question is insignificant. Okay, raise your hands if you think the answer to the question is significant. Okay, you're about evenly split here. That's really strange. The reason why you're evenly split is because there's indications of what Mordechai says both ways. Let's listen to the beginning what he says. If we just stopped right there and said, if you keep silent, we're going to be fine, we'll be saved some other way. Then I ask you, is Esther significant or insignificant? The answer is insignificant. But then listen to the end of what he says. But if you keep silent, at ubeit avich tavedu, you are going to be destroyed, umi yodea, imla et kazot higat l'malchut. And who knows if it was for this moment that you were chosen queen. Now is she significant or insignificant? Very significant. This is the moment for which you were chosen queen. Well, which is it? In the beginning you say she's not significant, now you say she's significant, so you can't have it both ways. What do you really mean? How is it possible that she's both significant and insignificant? Okay, so here is where I believe Chazal can be very helpful. There's two Chazal that I want to point out to you. And the theory I want to suggest to you is the Chazal in Medrash and Agadata and in Gemara, they say things, they often allude to larger ideas. They're showing you sometimes the tip of the iceberg and letting you infer the rest of the iceberg. Let me try to show you what it is I'm talking about. I think that there's two Chazal, which if you piece them together, are a part of an iceberg, but they strongly imply a third part of the iceberg, which will help us with the rest of our questions. And that brings us to the text you have up on the screen. Text which at face value seems to have nothing to do with the Megillah, but according to Chazal, has a lot to do with the Megillah. So take a look here at Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yud Aleph over here in Vayetze is the initial meeting between Yaakov and Rachel. Yaakov sees Rachel, kisses her, Vayisa'as kolo vayevk, and lifts up his voice and cries. Chazal were puzzled why he cries. Here he sees the woman of his dreams, he should be happy, why is he crying? So Rashi brings down two pshatim on why he's crying. Right? It's a famous Rashi. What does Rashi say? Pshat number one, Rashi says, based on Chazal, that the reason why Yaakov is crying is because he sees Ruach HaKodesh, that he won't be buried with her. Right? He sees the Enan Chneset Imalukvura. That's reason number one. What's reason number two? Reason number two is this long story that Rashi tells you, based upon Chazal, involving Alifaz. Right? You remember the story? The story goes like this. And when you read the story, you got to ask yourself, what were Chazal thinking? Like, why are they telling me this whole story? It seems like this whole long fairy tale that's coming out of thin air. So you have to ask yourself, what was the evidence that Chazal had that they spin me this tale? Okay? But here's the tale. Once upon a time, Esav dispatched Eliphaz to kill Yaakov. And Eliphaz was loyally hunting down Yaakov, and he catches up to him, and he's about to kill him. He has a dagger above his head, and then he like drops the dagger and he says, "I can't do it. I grew up in Yitzchak's household. I can't kill you, but I have a problem, because if I don't kill you, how can I possibly go back to my father with you alive?" right? Here's my problem. At that point, Yaakov gives him an etzah. Yaakov says, I have a great idea for you. Why don't you just take my money? And if you take my money, you can go back to your father and say that you killed me because ani nechshav kamet, a person who's poor, if like he's dead, so you can kind of sort of say that you killed me if you have all my money. That's the story. Now, the reason why he's crying, Chazal say, is because he's crying because he doesn't have any money. Right? This is the backstory of why he doesn't have any money. Why is he crying? Because he says, Eliezer, Evedav, right? Eliezer, my grandfather's servant, when he came to marry the woman of his dreams, he had a lot of money. But me, when I'm coming empty-handed, and that's why I'm crying, and this is the story of why he came empty-handed. Normally, he would have come with money, but he lost it all, he gave it all away to Eliphaz. Why are Chazal telling me such a strange story? What do they want me to learn for such a strange story, and how did they know it was true? Okay, so let's start with what the point of the story is. Also, when Rashi or Chazal bring down two explanations for something, one of the interesting things you could always do is, in yeshiva we are always trained that when there's an argument about something, we're trained to do what? Come on, guys. Whenever you have an argument about something, what do you do? You isolate the nekudas and achlokas. You try to find what is it that they're really arguing about, right? I want to actually ask you to do the opposite over here. I want you to ask, what is it that they're really agreeing about? This is actually sometimes the much more interesting thing to do in the machlokas, which is, gee, it's very interesting that they're arguing, but isn't it more interesting that despite their argument, they all agree on X, Y, Z, and Q, and they only argue about R? What is it that both of these statements of Chazal are really agreeing about? What's the point of both of them? A, that he saw Benavua that he wouldn't be buried with her, and B, this strange story about the money, that he lost his money, didn't have any money to give her. Yep.
He loses something.
And what does he lose?
Well, he's not compared to Rachel. That's one, he loses his relationship with her, right? And he loses money.
It's not about losing his money. It's about losing his money, because if he had his money, what would have happened? Exactly. Now, here's where we get to play something interesting. There's an interesting book called What If. It is an anthology of essays by eminent historians speculating on counterfactual history. So what they're doing is they're looking at what would have happened if, right? If one little thing had gone differently, what would have happened? What would have happened if, in 1920, and it so happens that Winston Churchill was visiting the United States, and he was walking on Fifth Avenue, and he was grazed by a taxi cab going down the street, and he was just slightly injured. What happens if he had been 10 inches more out in the street, and he had actually been hit by the cab and killed? How would world history have been different if Winston Churchill died in 1920? Right? That's one essay. What happened if the United States hadn't intercepted the Japanese codes before the Battle of Midway, and we didn't know where three Japanese aircraft carriers were, and we didn't manage to destroy the entire Japanese fleet at Midway? What would have happened then? What would have happened if we hadn't recovered, if the North hadn't recovered the fallen plans from a Southern colonel that had fallen out, which showed exactly where Lee's armies were encamped outside of Gettysburg, and Gettysburg had been won by the South instead of the North? How would world history have changed? So this is what the book is about, right? What if? What if we played what if in this story? Aren't Chazal really asking us to wonder, how would history have been different if Yaakov had money when he came to Rachel? What if he was a rich guy? What if he had been coming with all sorts of jewels and gold and all of that? What if he met Rachel and Laban that way? How would history have been different? He probably would have married Rachel and not been tricked into marrying Leah. Why? He just would have married her outright. The whole reason you have the whole trickery story is because he's this penniless pauper. He has nothing. So he comes and says, well, I don't have any money, but I can work for 7 years if you really want something. And Lovin looks at this little Schlemiel who's working for 7 years and says, yeah, fine, work for 7 years and then I'll trick you, right? Lovin knows what to respect. He respects men of wealth, of stature. And Chazal seem to be saying, in both of these Chazal are really saying the same thing. What does Yaakov lose? Yaakov loses Rachel. The moment that he sees her, Vayisak Hola Vayev, he cries because he intuits at that moment, that something is going to happen that is going to ultimately deprive him of Rachel, either in death or in life. In death, I'm not going to be buried with her. In life, something's going to intervene. What intervenes in life? What intervenes in life is Lavan. What happens? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. How is it that he loses Rachel? He ends up marrying Leah instead. He gets Rachel, but Rachel's always just outside of his grasp. How did Chazal know this to be true? How did Chazal know the whole story with Alifaz? What evidence do they possibly have for their speculation about him losing his money? I think the evidence comes from the text. Take a look at that language, Vayisak Kol HaVayev, when Yaakov cries. Now ask yourself this question. How many times in the Torah before now has the phrase Vayisak Kol HaVayev been used? This is the second Vayisak Kol HaVayev in the Torah. That means there was one before this. Where was the only other Vayisak Kol HaVayev in the Torah?
Esav.
When Yaakov tricked Esav. That's the only other Vayisak Kol HaVayev. Now listen to what Chazal are saying. All Chazal are saying is, they're saying, take the two Vayisak Kol HaVayev, and we're just going to plot the story that connects them. When Yaakov deceived his brother and caused his brother to cry with Vayisak Kol HaVayev, think about what happened at that moment. Father loved Esav. Father thought Esav was the Bechor. Yaakov said, you know what, take me instead. I can be him. He impersonates Esav. So, there's two siblings, right? Father loves one of two siblings. Yaakov says, take me instead. Father can't really see, so he doesn't really know. And as a result of that, Esav cried. Immediately after that, what does Esav do? Here's Chazal's story. Esav dispatches Eliphaz to go try and kill Yaakov, because remember in the Pasuk, what does Esav say? Right? Yigruvu yimei evel avi. Soon my father's going to die. Va'ahargat Yaakov achi, and I'm going to kill my father. So he dispatches Eliphaz to go kill him. Eliphaz catches up to him. Yaakov says, hey, take my money. Really? I can take your money? He says, yeah. Tell your father that you sort of, kind of killed me, right? Deceive your father the same way I deceived my father. It'll kind of work out. And Yaakov thinks it worked out, but there's only one problem, which is that he arrives at Rachel's house without money. And now what happens? After 7 years of labor, Laban deceives him. And he's the one who's crying. Laban deceives him. So one second, how many siblings were there? There were two girls. They were sisters. Yaakov loved one of two siblings. But along came the father, when Yaakov couldn't really see. And Yaakov and the father substituted one for the other. And when Yaakov calls him on it in the morning and says, Lama ribi tami, what does Lavan say? Lo yasa ken bimkomenu lateta tatzira lifnei abachira. We don't do it that way where we come from, to give the younger before the older. What are Chazal really saying? They're saying what goes around comes around. It's just the same story. This Vayisak Kol HaVayev comes from that Vayisak Kol HaVayev. If you want to understand why Yaakov is deprived of Rachel, you have to understand it's just tit for tat what he did with his own brother. It's a function of the first Vayisak Kol HaVayev. Okay, this is the first Chazal. I mentioned to you there were two Chazals, so here's the second Chazal. It turns out, if we go back to the story of Yaakov's deception of Esav, so Vayisak Kol HaVayev is not actually the only piece of language that describes Esav's tears.
This is the other piece of language.
Vayitzak tzaka gdola amara ad ma'od. Esav lets out a great and bitter cry. Now, it turns out we've heard those words before, too. There's one other time in Tanakh where you have Vayitzak tzaka gdola amara, except it's not with the tzadi, it's with the zayin. Where's the only other Vayitzak tzaka gdola amara? We know where that is. That's in the Megillah. So, Chazal and Esther Rava pick up on that, too. And they say, okay, you want to know why Mordechai cries great and bitter tears? Because Mordechai is the child of Yaakov. And who is Haman? Haman is from Agag. Agag is from Amalek. Amalek is from Eliphaz. And Eliphaz is from Esav. Amalek is a child of Esav. And Amalek remembers the great and bitter cry of Esav. And therefore, Chazal say, anyone who says HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Vatran, that God is not someone who insists on justice, but God just allows things to slide, doesn't know what he's talking about. Because Esav's tears were repaid centuries later by Mordechai's tears with the decree of Haman, the potential for genocide. Now, if you think about that, that's a very chilling Chazal. The implications of Chazal there are that don't think that Haman's genocidal decree was just something that Haman did on his own. It had, at some level, the backing of heaven, right? There was a moral leg that Haman had to stand on. It was the tears of his ancestor Esav, and this was just payback. And that God himself, so to speak, is behind that in some way. Now, I want to ask you a question. If we accept this Chazal, this second Chazal, and we go back to Mordechai's speech to Esther, the speech in which Mordechai says, everything's going to be okay, because Revach Vatzala Yamod Leidim Makom Acher. Isn't that a strange thing for him to say? If Chazal are really right, if it's really true that we are meant to interpret Haman's genocidal decree as having a leg to stand on in Shemayim because of Esav's tears, then how does Mordechai know that everything's going to be okay? How does Mordechai know that heaven's going to save us? If heaven is behind Haman's decree, how do you know that heaven's not going to go all the way and kill us? How do you know, or how do you know it's not going to be a disaster? How does he know we're going to be saved? Okay. So this brings us to an interesting question. I suggested to you that when you look at Chazal, sometimes you see the beginning of the iceberg, but if you look a little bit more carefully, you can infer the rest of the iceberg. Let's try to infer the rest of the iceberg. Let's take these two Chazal that talk about Esav's tears. The first that talks about Vayitzak Kol Vayev. The second that talks about Vayitzak Tzak HaGdola Amara. Let's plot them on a graph for a moment. Let's imagine we're graphing these Chazal. So here's what the way the graph is going to look like. Let's see. Do these work? These work? I can write on here with these, you think? All right. So let's take this dot over here. Let that dot represent Yaakov's deception of Esav and the tears of Esav. Okay? As we go forward into Yaakov's life, there comes a point in which we have another Vayisak HaLavayev, and Chazal connect these two points. They're drawing this horizontal line in Yaakov's life, right? But all of this is in one generation, so it's a horizontal line. But let's say the axis of time, right, is along the y-axis, and way up here later on in history, Chazal identified this other point, which is the Vayitzak Tzak HaGdola Amara point of Mordechai, and says not only can you draw this horizontal line to later on in Yaakov's life and say that his tears over here at the loss of Rachel come from this point, but it's also Mordechai's tears way up here in history that also come back from this point. They're drawing a vertical line, so to speak, and a horizontal line. Okay, now if we play connect the dots, what's the only dots left unconnected? There's one more line you could draw. What's the other line that you could draw? Between Yaakov and Haman. in this picture, there's another line you can draw. What's the line? A little bit of geometry. A hypotenuse. Thank you. This line. Are they implying a hypotenuse? Now the question is, what would the hypotenuse look like in Tanakh? If this is a vertical line within Yaakov's life, and saying that Yaakov's loss of Rachel over here, potential loss of Rachel, is predicated upon Yaakov's deception of Esav. And this is a point up here, which is Mordechai's tears at genocide. And that means that this line would have to be some event that connects these two dots, i.e., is there a moment in Chazal that you can think of, which is that line where these two events are connected, which is to say, the potential loss of Rachel is connected to Mordechai's tears at Haman's decree. Where in Tanakh do we have the potential loss of Rachel connected to Mordechai's tears at Haman's decree?
Eliphaz?
No, because Eliphaz is way before Mordechai. It's got to be in Mordechai's generation. Who's Rachel in Mordechai's generation?
Esther.
Esther. Why Esther? And what tribe does Mordechai come from? Binyamin. Ah, who's Binyamin? Binyamin's from Rachel. The latter-day Rachel, the child of Rachel, in the Megillah, is actually Esther. And isn't it interesting that listen to what Mordechai is saying? Mordechai is saying, we're going to be fine, but you know what? My tears and this decree, ultimately the real victim here, is going to be you, Esther. You're a child of Rachel. You're the one threatened. The hypotenuse would actually be this very speech, which Mordechai is giving to Esther right now. And I want you to listen carefully to this speech. And let's play our game one more time. We've seen that Chazal played a where have we heard these words before game in coming up with these two assumptions. They said Vayisa Kol Vayevk over here is connected to Vayisa Kol Vayevk over here. And Vayitzak Tzaka Gedola Amara over here is connected to Vayitzak Tzaka Gedola Amara over here. What about the hypotenuse that's implied? Is there another game to be played with words that shows up in the hypotenuse? The hypotenuse is going to be Mordechai's speech to Esther about her possible loss. So let's listen to the words one more time. If you keep silent right now, this time, Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yidi mimakam acher. Space and salvation will come from some other place. Now let's actually think about those words. If you were writing it, would you have written it that way? If you wanted to say everything's going to be okay, would you have actually chosen the words Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yidi mimakam acher? First of all, it's wordy. You could have said it in one word. Which word would you have chosen? Yeshua, maybe. You would have avoided Revach and Hatzalah. If you had to choose one of them, maybe you would choose Hatzalah. You for sure wouldn't have used Revach. You don't know what you mean by that. Revach means like space. Space and salvation. What does that even mean? Why is Mordechai using such strange terminology? Revach v'Hatzalah yamod la'yidi mimakam acher. Let's play our game. Where else have we heard the term Revach in Tanakh? Turns out, the Baal HaTorim says, that there is no other Revach in Tanakh except for one other place. This is the second time in Tanakh Revach ever appears. There's only one other Revach in Tanakh. What's that? Well, that's Merchav spelled differently, right? Well, it's that's true. I'm looking for the exact word Revach, right? Exactly. It's in the Yaakov and Esav story. Which part of the Yaakov and Esav story? In Parshas Vayishlach. What's happening in Parshas Vayishlach? It's in the reconciliation story. It's when Yaakov seeks out Esav. He's going home. And on his way, he sends Malachim to Esav, his brother. He wants to meet him again after all these years. And Esav comes back and he has 400 men. And he's worried that he's going to lose everything. Then there's going to be one more place. So what does he do? So he sends gifts to him. And when he sends gifts to him, he gives him gifts. And he says, Kach na es birchasi, take my blessing. By the way, think of those words. Kach na et birchati. What's he really doing?
He's
I stole the bracha. What am I saying now? I'm giving it back to you. Right? Take it back. I'm giving you the stuff. Whatever it was, we can go on. We can make up. Yeshli kol, yeshli rav. When they see each other, they hug. They kiss. Interestingly, they cry. The problem started with tears. When Yaakov provoked unilateral tears on the part of Esav, Esav cried and Yaakov didn't. And then there would come another time, according to Chazal, when Yaakov alone would cry at the prospect that he would lose Rachel. But here's the moment when they hug and they kiss Vayivku. They both cry. And that's a moment of reconciliation. But along the way to that reconciliation, when Yaakov sends those gifts, he says, Revach tasimu bein eder le'eder. That's the only other Revach in Tanakh. Place space between each of those gifts. And not only that, when he prays to God, when he says, Revach tasimu bein eder le'eder, what does he say to God? Hatzilenina miyad achi miyad esav. Miyad esav. Revach and Hatzalah will save us. Will come from another place. What's the other place? Listen to what Mordechai is really saying. Mordechai is referencing the reconciliation of Yaakov with Esav. So, if it's true that you can draw this line, if it's true that the tears of Mordechai can be traced to the tears of Esav, if it's true that Amalek, that Haman has a leg to stand on in Shemayim, a moral leg through which to prosecute us, it's also true that there's an Achilles heel to Haman. There's an Achilles heel to Amalek. The Achilles heel is the hypotenuse. Revach batzalah yamot laidim makom acher. There's one thing that Amalek will not remember, chooses not to remember. Amalek remembers the beginning of the story of Yaakov and Esav, but not the end of the story. They remember the tears. They remember the deception. And their heart is full of hatred because of that deception. When does Amalek attack us? Ata ayef v'yageya. V'lo yorei Elohim. That's the second ayef in the Torah. Where is the first? Esav. When Esav comes back from the field, who ayef. They remember that. They're always going to attack you remembering that. All of their memories focus on the very beginning. None of their memories focus on the end. And ultimately, what's our war against Amalek? What do we wipe out? Timcha es Zecher Amalek. Isn't that interesting? It's a war of memories. Wipe out the memories of Amalek. The memories of Amalek are poisonous. A skewed memory that only remembers the beginning of the story and doesn't remember the end of the story, that memory is destructive. That memory will completely destroy us. We know that God's going to save us because, in fact, there was an end to the story. There was a Revach Tassimu Bene Veleida. There was a Hatzileni Na Miyad Achi Miyad Esav. And because of that, Revach Vatzalah Yamad Leidim Vatam Lacher. We're going to be fine. But there's only one little loose end. And that is, why does he say, we'll be fine, but you might go down in flames? Why would she go down in flames? He seems to be suggesting that there's something about the tears of Esav which bear particular potency for you as a daughter of Rachel. You are much more vulnerable than any of us. The tears of Esav can always deprive Yaakov of Rachel. That's what Chazal say. Vayisa kol vayev. You could be taken away. Even as we're saved, you could be taken away. You have only one hope, he's telling her. The only way to avoid you being swept away in this Holocaust, not us, but you, is if you speak up, if you are not silent. If you are silent, in Acharesh Tacharishi, that will seal your fate. Why? Why will her silence seal her fate, even though we're going to be fine? Remember Amalek, and remember the beginning of the story. They don't remember the end of the story. So put that in the back of your mind now. And now let's talk about Esther. Let's go back to the second to first question I asked you, right? The question about Esther's strange speech to the king, referencing Nimkarnu Aniva Ami Lashni Larvagalai Ilu Lavadim Lishvachot Nimkarnu Hakarashti.
Where did my cup go?
Okay, so here I want to reference an idea that I make, the point I make in my book, in the third section of the book. Who was it that was threatened in the times of Mordechai and Esther? We all know that there was a genocide against the Jews, right? The Jews in Hebrew are the Yehudim. So we all know that the Yehudim were threatened. We all know who the Yehudim were, right? The Yehudim are the Jews. How do we know that? Because we all know what Yehudim are, right? The state of Israel is a Medina Yehudit, it's all, right? We got it. But we're probably wrong. Because the idea of Yehudi, meaning Jew, is a modern idea. That's what we think the word means now. The question isn't what the word means now. The question is what the word meant then. At the times of the Megillah, what did the term Yehudi mean? Now notice that throughout Tanakh, Yehudi doesn't really appear. You don't have the word Yehudi in Chumash. We weren't known as Jews, we were known as Bnei Yisrael. Yehudi pops up very, very late in Tanakh, around the times of the Book of Esther. Why is it that it's right now that for the first time you really hear about these people called the Yehudim? Who are these people, the Yehudim? Think about it historically. Who are these guys? The answer is they're people not just from Shevet Yehuda, but historically they're from Malchut Yehuda, right? Malchut Yehuda. Historically, what happened, right? So there was the 10 tribes, they had been exiled by Sancheirav long before. So who was left? What left in Eretz Yisrael was Malchut Yehuda, the southern kingdom. Now, we all know that Malchut Yehuda wasn't just Malchut Yehuda. Who else was Malchut Yehuda? Malchut Yehuda was also Shevet Binyamin. So Binyamin was there too, but Binyamin was, comparatively speaking, a much smaller. And therefore, and Yehuda was in charge, and so it was known as Malchut Yehuda. So when Nebuchadnezzar came, and Galus Bavel started, and when Paros of Madai swept in and took over Bavel so that it now became, right, Persia, the people who were there were known as Yehudim. That wasn't a religious designation. That was a national designation. Their passport said Yehudi on them, right? They were remnants of Malchus Yehuda. When Haman is plotting against Yehudim, and he says, Yeshno anachad mufuzam vora beinonim, he's talking about the remnants of Malchus Yehuda. He's not interested in who's from Binyamin and who's from Yehuda. He's just interested in Malchus Yehuda. They're all the same. But just because from Haman's perspective, they're all the same. Just because from Persia's perspective, they're all the same. Doesn't mean from our perspective, they're all the same. So in other words, if you were in Malchus Yehuda, tribal affiliation still mattered. You knew if you were from Binyamin. You knew if you were from Yehuda. This sets up that dramatic moment in the Megillah where we actually stand up. You ever wonder why we stand up at Mordechai's introduction? Like, it's called Megillah's Esther. Why don't we stand up for Esther's introduction? Why do we stand up for Mordechai's introduction? Mordechai's introduction goes like this. Ish Yehudi Hayabu Shushan Avira Ushma Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Yemini. What story is that pasuk telling you? There was a guy who was a Yehudi, whose passport said Yehudi. To all outward appearances, he's a Yehudi, except, the Bala Megillah wants to tell you, to understand what happens next, you need to understand one other crucial thing. Ish Yemini. He was actually from the tribe of Binyamin. Now, if he's actually from the tribe of Binyamin, that makes things very interesting, doesn't it? When he's saying to Esther, Im hachareish tacharishi ba'et hazot, if you keep silent at this time. By the way, listen to the word silence. Hachareish, from the word cheresh. If you make yourself deaf. Deaf to what? To the plight of the Yehudim. Why would someone from Binyamin might make themselves deaf to the plight of the Yehudim? Let's go back a little bit in history. What historical interactions have we had between Binyamin and Yehuda that might have led to a little bit of lingering resentment? Pelagish of Giva, for starters, right? That was a civil war which turned out rather badly. Binyamin was decimated in a war against Yehuda. Going back a little farther to the earliest tensions between Binyamin and Yehuda.
When he takes Binyamin down to Mitzrayim.
Even before that, what would you say the source of the grandfather of all tensions between Binyamin and Yehuda would have been? The great event. What? Binyamin is Rachel's son. It's going to be Mechiras Yosef. If you are Binyamin at the moment when Mechiras Yosef happens, right, you're traumatized. Your brother from Rachel just thrown the pit, sold as slaves, and who was the mastermind? Yehuda, right? I mean, he's the guy who says, "Ma betza kinaro v'nachim v'ksinu asdama l'chu v'nim k'reinu l'yishmeilim." L'chu v'nim k'reinu l'yishmeilim. How do you spell nim k'reinu? Nun mem chaf resh nun vav. You know there's only one other nun mem chaf resh nun vav in all of Tanakh? What's the only other nun mem chaf resh nun vav other than ma betza kinaro v'zachinu v'ksinu asdama l'chu v'nim k'reinu l'yishmeilim? It's in Megillas Esther, in Esther's first speech to the king. Ilu la'avadim v'lishvachos nimkarnu hecharashti. Listen to what she's saying. She's saying an incredible thing. She's referencing the words that Yehuda used to sell the brother of Binyamin into slavery. And what is she saying? Let's first listen to what Yehuda said. What did Yehuda say? Was Yehuda a good guy or a bad guy in the sale of Yosef? If you consider the sale of Yosef bad, was he a good guy or a bad guy? The answer is it's kind of hard to tell. Here's why. Because without Yehuda, what had been the plan before Yehuda comes along with this idea to sell him as a slave? The plan was to kill him. To kill him and to throw his corpse in the pit. Or, failing that, to let him die in the pit. He's in the pit. He's going to die in the pit. That was the plan. Reuben's the one who's going to come back and save him, but Reuben doesn't tell anybody that. As far as everybody else knows, the plan is to let him die. So along comes Yehuda and saves him. But instead of saving him all the way, he makes this sort of Faustian bargain, right? And what does he do? He says, look, guys, ma betza kinara gesachinu v'chisinu estamo. Let's plot it out. Let's say we kill him. How bad is that for him on a scale of 0 to 10? That's about a 10. How good is it for us? We don't get anything out of it. It's a 0. But let's say instead we sell him as a slave. How bad is it for him? That's about a 7. Right? Now, how good is it for us? We get some profit out of that. It's about a 3, 3.5. Let's sell him as a slave. It's the same bargain that Esther's talking about. The same thing, the same Excel spreadsheet. That is the spreadsheet that Yehuda used when he said, Ma betza kinaro g'nachinu, let's not kill him, let's sell him as a slave. He was sort of a good guy. Mordechai says, Esther, you're from Binyamin, but you can't keep silent at the fate of the Yehuda. When she goes before the king, she says, look, I'm willing to risk my life. Please save them. Save them because they're going to be killed. But I just want to mention that if you were only considering selling them as slaves instead, I think I could have kept quiet for that. I mean, that's what she's saying. Because we know the history. Yehuda kept quiet for that. Yehuda wouldn't kill Yosef, but he would have sold him as a slave. So I'm not going to let that Judah be killed either. But sold as slaves, maybe. Now, did she say this? I don't know whether she said this. The Baal Megillah puts these words in her mouth, I think, as a way of alerting to you the bitterness, the bitter historical memories that Esther's carrying with her. And somehow, that bitterness makes her fail. She does not succeed at this moment when she goes before the king. And if the story ended here, the Jews would die and Esther would not be a heroine. What makes Esther a heroine? What makes her a heroine is that she went before the king one more time. And when she went before the king one more time, what did she say? Let's go to that last speech.
Right there, right? Right, you were just there. Right there.
Where's your last speech? I don't know where it is. There's something else. There it is. So look at this. Here's her second speech.
She says, you have to save the Jews. How can I possibly stand by and watch the terrible evil that befalls my people? There too, she's quoting. Eich er'ah bara asher yimsa es ami sure sounds a lot like Eich er'ah bara asher yimsa et avi, doesn't it? Who said Eich er'ah bara asher yimsa es avi? How can I possibly see the evil that befalls my father? Yehuda said that. About who? Binyamin. That was the end of the story. There was an end of the story, too. Not just a beginning of the story. The beginning of the story was Machiras Yosef. Yes, that was a bad part of the story. But listen to the end of the story. The end of the story was that Yehuda had the chance to do it one more time. Yehuda one more time could have sold a child of Rachel off to slavery. It would have been perfectly understandable. As a matter of fact, by rights, Binyamin should have been killed. Nobody knows that Binyamin is framed. Binyamin is caught red-handed with the king's goblet. Yehuda himself says, the person who has the goblet will die. He should die. Along comes Yosef. No one knows it's Yosef, the Egyptian official. And the Egyptian official says, I'm not going to kill him. He's going to be my slave, and all of you guys can go home. He's just going to be a slave. He's not going to die. One more time, the Excel spreadsheet is open. The possibility of death is off the table. Instead, he's just going to be a slave. Make the bargain again, Yehuda. Just let him go. He's not going to be killed. He'll just be a slave. But Yehuda says, I'm not going to make that mistake again. So Yehuda launches into a speech. And in that speech, he says, look, I have to tell you the truth. And he goes through the whole long story. And he says, I have to tell you, my father had a wife. And he said to me, when I was bringing Binyamin down, he said, Ata yadati kishnayim yoda li ishti. You know that my wife only gave birth to two children. Now how hard is it for Yehuda to say those words? My wife only gave birth to two children? Is that true that Yaakov's wife only gave birth to two children? All of Leah's children are chopped liver? They don't count? I don't count? The only ones who count are Yosef and Binyamin? That's it? But in Yaakov's eyes, that's how Yehuda sees it. The only one, right? Yosef is gone. And you're going to take Binyamin from with me? If you do that, how is my father ever going to recover? Nafsho k'shurah b'nafsho. His soul is bound up with Binyamin because his soul was bound up with Rachel. Because he loved the other woman more than he loved my mother. And there was a time that I was willing to sell the child of that rival wife into slavery because I couldn't look that harsh fact in the eye. But this will not be that time. Take me instead. Father would want me to stay and Binyamin to go. So let him go and take me instead. Eich er'ah bara asher yimsa es avi. How can I possibly see the evil that would befall my father? That's what Yehuda said about Binyamin. Now when did Binyamin ever repay Yehuda for that? It took a long time, but the answer is now. In the Megillah, Binyamin, the child of Binyamin, Esther, repays Yehuda for that with these words. Look at what's going on here. What's going on here, and this is the point I want to leave you with, is that when you think about good and evil in the Megillah, we think about the Megillah as a child story. We think about good as being white and evil as being black, and we think that there's this, right? If I asked you, okay, on a scale from 0 to 10, how bad is Haman on the badness scale? He's about a 10. On a scale from 0 to 10, how good is Mordechai and Esther on the goodness scale? They're about a 10. So it's a good 20 points, right? Distance between Haman and Esther, right? Wrong. I want to argue to you that there's the thinnest of lines that divide Esther, and Haman. And that's really the title of this talk. How thin is the line between Esther and Haman? The thinnest of lines. The truth is, they're in exactly the same situation. They have exactly the same choice to make. The only difference between Esther and Haman is what choice will you make in that situation? They both have a beginning of the story, and they both have an end of the story. How will they relate to it? And guess what? It's the same story, just in different generations. What's the story Haman remembers? It's the story of Yaakov and Esav. What's the story that Esther remembers? The story of Mechiras Yosef. Think about those two stories. Yaakov and Esav, what happened? In the Yaakov and Esav story, brothers deceived a father and betrayed a brother, taking a goat, right? And slaughtering a goat and bringing it to father, dressed up with the coat of his brother and saying, you might like him, but take me instead. That's what Yaakov did to his father Yitzchak. It was a story of goats and coats. There was another story of goats and coats. It happened a generation later. It happened when brothers took a goat and they slaughtered it and they put the blood on the coat of their brother and they brought the coat together with the blood of the goat to their father and said, you might like him, but take me instead. It's the same story happening in the next generation. The question is, how are you going to relate to goats and coats? Our war for eternity is not with Esav. It's only with Amalek. Amalek is that part of Esav that says, I am the real Esav. Esav sold out. The real Esav is the Esav that remembers the betrayal, remembers the beginning of the story. Everything else is a distraction. There was a reconciliation. It wasn't complete. It wasn't final. It wasn't good enough. I don't pay attention to the reconciliation. It's a choice. The choice is, how will you choose to remember? Esther has the same choice too. If Esther is done after her first audience to the king, she is not a heroine. She's in the same boat. She's only a heroine because she chooses, she makes a choice to remember the rest of the story. A choice which she didn't have to make. If she wants in her head, she can make the choice to be nurtured off the anger. Ultimately, it really is a choice. In both cases, you could argue about the reconciliation. Did Yosef and his brothers really completely reconcile? Maybe yes, maybe no. It's complicated. You could argue there are complicated situations. The bottom line is the situation started badly. There was an attempted reconciliation in both stories. How do you relate to that? Mordechai says, Esther, we are going to survive. That's for sure. Because Amalek doesn't have it right. They only remember the beginning of the story. They don't remember the Revach Vatzalah. That's why God will save us, because God knows something that Amalek doesn't know. God knows that there was a reconciliation, and therefore we will be saved. The only question is, Esther, what about you? Because we all know that the tears of Mordechai, that the tears that Yaakov provoked on the part of Esav are particularly fatal for Yaakov's ability to have Rachel. That's why the Vayisa Kol HaVayef of Yaakov with Rachel follows after the Vayisa Kol HaVayef of Yaakov with Esav. We all know that Yaakov's tears, that the tears that Yaakov provokes from Esav are particularly fatal for a child of Rachel. You are a child of Rachel. You have a choice to make. If you choose not to save the Yehudim, if you choose to be silent, if you choose to only remember the beginning of the story, Mechiras Yosef, and not to remember the reconciliation, then what are you really saying? You're saying only beginnings of stories count, right? Not the ends of stories. If you say only beginnings of stories count and not the ends of stories, where does that leave you with the story that Amalek remembers? Where does that leave you with the story that Haman remembers? That leaves you right where Amalek is. You are saying they're right to only remember the beginning of the story and not the end. If they're right, if only the beginning of the story matters, then you're going to go down. Atu beit avich tavedu. Rachel will always die if the only thing you remember is the beginning of the Yaakov and Esav story. In order to save yourself, you have to remember the end of stories in order to say that the ends of stories matter. God remembers the ends of stories, but what about you? If you say it's only about the beginning, then that's the way you'll be judged too. You'll go down. Esther is a hero, Haman is a villain, but the line between them is very, very close. And it's a line, by the way, that we all face. If you haven't faced it yet in your life, one day you will. You live in a family long enough, you live with brothers long enough, you live with people long enough, stuff happens. The stuff is, there's some sort of betrayal that goes on, some sort of bad feelings, some sort of something. And then usually, there's some moment, sometimes it's days later, sometimes it's weeks later, sometimes it's years later, where there's an attempt at reconciliation. Where you think you were victimized, when the other fellow comes to you and says, let's make up. And as you walk away from that reconciliation, there's probably going to be a part of you that says, was that good enough? Was that really good enough? Can I really let go on the basis of that? Shouldn't he have said it differently? Shouldn't have she have said it differently? And at that point, you have a choice to make. You have a complicated situation, but there's precedence for that choice in our history. All of Sefer Bereishis is about those two complicated situations, situations where there's betrayal, and there's an attempt at reconciliation, and it's just complicated. And now as you go forward, your choice is, how are you going to remember? And that's the choice. The choice is, what is going to fuel you? That's a decision. In life, what fuels you is emotional energy. There's all sorts of emotional energy that can fuel you. Ambition can fuel you. Ambition to be a great investment banker and to make millions of dollars. Ambition to be the very best Rebbe you can be. Ambition to be the very best father you can be. Ambition is one kind of passion that can fuel you. There's another thing that can fuel you, that can give you the alacrity to get up in the morning and to face a day, to plod onwards in life and to go forwards. Love can fuel you. Love of your wife, love of your parents, love of your children. You can wake up every morning, you can be fueled by love. Love is a great fuel. Chazal tell us, Ahava mekalkelas es ashura, right? If you have love as a fuel, you just go, and nothing stands in your way. But there's one other thing that can fuel you. Sinan mekalkelas es ashura, too. Hatred can fuel you. You can make a choice to be fueled by hatred. And we all know people like that. People that wake up in the morning looking, whether they admit it or to themselves or not, for the thing that they're going to be resentful about today, because that's going to fuel them. And that hatred leaches out, doesn't leave room for love. It becomes the fuel. And if that fuels you, then in these situations, you can't afford to look at reconciliation, because it drains the vitality out of your fuel of life. The fuel of your life is the passion of the hatred. All you can look at is the anger and the resentment. You're too invested in the beginning of the story to look at the rest of the story. And that's Amalek. Why do we hate Amalek? I don't think it's because Amalek is abstract evil, is the devil in the sky. I think it's because Amalek is making a choice that's evil. And it's also a choice that is dangerous. It is, if you are fueled by hatred, what will happen? Here's the really scary thing. Let's say Esther made a choice to not speak up for the Yehudim. Who would die? So you would say the Yehudim would die. Who would live? Here's the scary thing. The answer is no one. Who's in Malchus Yehuda? Yehuda and Binyamin. That means that if Esther is silent, that little possibility that she's playing with when she talks about Heferashti, if she's silent, who goes down? Everyone goes down, even Binyamin. Think about Amalek. Amalek's hatred is such, according to Rashi in Parshas Bashalah, they jump into the Bati Rotacha without any sense that it even matters whether they're going to live or die. Why? Because when you're fueled by hatred, it doesn't matter. When you're fueled by hatred, of course, I'm willing to go down if I can get those bastards. Whatever it takes. Ultimately, hatred is self-destructive. You'll destroy yourself. It doesn't matter. You're the suicide bomber. And a suicide bomber can't be deterred. You can't deter Amalek. If you're fueled by hatred, it just doesn't matter anymore. So, if your way of seeing things is skewed, all you can remember is one side of the story. You won't remember the rest of the story. So, as the Rambam says, you kore l'shalom, right, even to Amalek, and you offer yourself as a peace treaty, you offer a peace treaty. If they accept the peace treaty, they're not Amalek anymore. But if they don't accept it, if they keep that vision, they're suicide bombers. How do you deal with an enemy? You either make peace with them, or you deter them through detente. Or if you can't deter them because there is no deterrence, the only other choice is to battle against them, to battle at them till the end, because they'll battle with you until the end. It's just a war of self-preservation. But the choice we all have to make is who we are. Being fueled by hatred is a very seductive thing. Hatred is just as seductive as love, right? It pulls you in just as much as love. But that's the choice of Amalek. Esther is a heroine because she turns her back on that choice and chooses love rather than hatred. But that's a choice, right? That's a choice. And I think that's the example she leaves us on Purim. So with that, I will wish you a good night and a happy night.